Hi, this is Iris Jackson, and this is Miracles Happen, Dreams Do Come True. And as again today, we have a very special guest, Peter Mount Shasta from Mount Shasta. Welcome, Peter.
Why, thank you, Iris. It's good to be here again.
Thank you. Peter is the author of The Open Door.
I am The Open Door. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I am The Open Door. And there is another book called The Open Door, which is really good.
Good.
But I Am The Open Door is the most beautiful, the all-around most beautiful book I have ever held in my hand or looked at. It is so filled with light, and I think it's a must-have in every library.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
Yeah. I have a friend that goes into the local bookstore, and he takes the book off the shelf. He does this almost every day, and he just sits down and meditates on the cover. I Am The Open Door. And then he sits there for about half an hour doing that, puts the book back, and leaves. The bookstore owner's not too happy about it, but he brings a lot of other people in with his good energy.
Well, who knows how much the light is intensified by that meditation.
Absolutely. That's what I told the owner, was that, you know, he refers other people to the book, and he brings a lot of people in there. Just they feel the pull, and people go up to him and say, I feel your energy. What is it? What are you doing? And he says, well, I'm meditating on the I Am, and then he recommends that book, you know.
Uh-huh.
So, anyway.
Well, you know, Peter, I feel like you've been on two other shows,
mm-hmm.
and today you want to talk about right action.
Sure.
Before you wanted to talk about meeting the masters and how to do that, and then, but I feel like we need to sort of back up,
sure,
and say how the open door came to be, and then kind of do a history and bring it up to present time, how you came to be writing Adventures of a Western Mystic,
sure,
Apprentice to the Masters,
right,
which is about to come out. And so I want to be sure we cover everything. You know, we bring it all up to date because,
sure,
we've both gotten excited and kind of talked about a lot of different things,
mm-hmm, sure,
when you've been on. So,
sure. Okay, well, let's see. What happened was, you know, my teacher Pearl always taught that you didn't need to channel, or that you really, it was really, could take you away from the past, you know, that if you were going to other people to find out what you need to find out inside, that it was going to weaken you. And so I, you know, always stayed away from that. I didn't go to channels or psychics.
Pearl was a channel.
Well, she channels her higher self, but she didn't say, in the sense that we all do. I mean, we couldn't take a breath without the higher self coming through us, because that's where the energy comes from that makes us breathe and our hearts beat, you know.
Yes.
So we're all channels of the higher self to greater and lesser degree. But she never gave people messages from the masters. I mean, on rare occasions, she might say, I feel that Saint Germain is very happy with you, or he's saying, well done, or something like that, you know. But she never told people. People didn't go to her for messages from the masters. Where should I go? What should I do? Should I get married? Should I get divorced? You know, all that kind of stuff that people who don't want to take the responsibility for their own lives, you know, go to someone else. I mean, I don't really want to put people down for doing that, because, you know, there are many valid ways to get guidance, such as astrology and, you know, many other ways that if you're not totally in touch with your I Am presence, you sort of look to other things for clues, you know,
uh-huh,
including talking to friends and so on. But she didn't, she never channeled the masters in the sense that, okay, now this is such and such a master speaking through me and he's telling you to do this and so on.
Why did you go to Pearl?
Well, I met her in Muir Woods. I met Saint Germain in Muir Woods. He materialized in front of me. I was contemplating suicide, and this being, just because I felt like I'd done everything on earth I wanted to do, and I didn't want to hang out here for the rest of my life, just browsing in malls.
You didn't come to this planet to eat your lunch.
Yeah, just to browse in malls and, you know, drive sports cars and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah, you were pretty much been there, done that, huh?
Yeah, after I went through college, and then I lived in New York for a while, and I sort of led the fast life for a while and did everything I really ever wanted to do that I thought was going to bring me happiness, and found that in the end really didn't. Then I went to India and spent time with Ram Dass's guru, Neem Karoli Baba, and then spent time with Sai Baba, and they taught me the way to go within and to find higher realms and to find the bliss within myself. And that sort of led me to wanting to hang out more on those planes, you know, to spend more time in meditation. So at that time, my meditation pretty much consisted of just going within and shutting out the world and going into a higher world that were very blissful. And so at that point, I knew yogis in India that could leave their bodies consciously, and the last one that I stayed with in the Himalayas was preparing, after I left, he was going to go into samadhi for 21 days and leave his body. So I thought that sounded pretty good. I would come back and do the same thing myself. So I was in Muir Woods saying, if there's anybody up there that hears me, and I named all the divine beings I could think of, you know, Jesus and Saint Germain and Sai Baba and Buddha and so on, show me if there's a reason to stay on the earth. Otherwise, I'm going to leave my body. And at that point, this being just materialized out of the air in front of me. And I was off the beaten path, you know, and I was inside a redwood tree that was hollowed out from fire. And it was raining, and I had sat inside the tree to get out of the rain. So there was nobody else around. And I was doing this Vipassana meditation with my eyes open, looking at the ground. So I would have seen someone walking up, and I would have heard the twigs crackle and things like that. So all of a sudden, I saw these 2 feet in front of me, and I looked up, and there was this young man there wearing blue jeans and, you know, a suede jacket, and he just looked like someone you would expect to see walking in the woods. But I knew he hadn't been walking there. He just appeared. So
yes.
he knew my name, and he said, "Peter, your prayer has been heard. I am the part of the Godhead that has responded to your request." And he took me out of my physical body to the higher realms and showed me that I could stay there if I wanted. But at that point, I heard the crying on the earth, and I saw the suffering, and I said, "I want to go back and help." My heart just went out. There was no way I could stand seeing that suffering and turn my back on it. And then he said, "You made the right choice." And he said, "Go to Mount Shasta. The first person you see will tell you what to do next." And then the next thing, I'm back in my body in Muir Woods, and he's standing in front of me, and he said, "Now I'll show you who I am." And he took a few steps back, and in front of me, he changed into this, like morphed into this being wearing a white robe. And I remembered his picture from the front of Unveiled Mysteries, and then he just faded out and disappeared. So then I got in my car sort of feeling numb, you know, and drove to Mount Shasta. And the first person that I saw was the guy that ran the health food store. And he said, "You should see this woman by the name of Pearl." So I went to see her, and she said, "I've been expecting you." And I said, "What do you mean?"
What year was this, Peter?
73, I believe. I had been to Mount Shasta the year before, but she'd been in seclusion then. And so I said, "What do you mean you were expecting me?" And she said, "The Master Saint Germain came to me this morning and told me he was sending someone to see me." And she said, "What brought you here?" And she wanted to hear my story, and I told her about this experience in Muir Woods. And she said, "Well, who do you think that was?" And I said, "Well, I think that was Saint Germain." And she said, "That's absolutely correct." See, he hadn't told me his name.
Uh-huh.
And she said, "Well, he's here." And, you know, if ever she was going to channel, that would have been the time. But she said, "He's here. and he wants to work with you. And I said, well, can you give me a message from him? And she said, he doesn't work that way. He wants you to get it yourself. He's giving you a message. And I said, well, I don't hear anything. And she said, that's because he doesn't want your human mind to interfere. He's giving it to your higher body, your higher mind. And when the time comes, you'll know what you need to know. It's kind of like the Vulcan mind merge. You know, he's merging, he's transmitting directly from his mind to your higher mind the lesson. So you're not, he's not allowing you to hear it with your human mind because you would argue and make changes and, you know, try to interfere and things like that. So that began my teaching, my study with Pearl over a period of perhaps five to seven years. And at one point I was back in New York, and on my way, I had one of those trips where I started out and I didn't know where I was going, you know, just sort of going on faith. And in fact, I was driving south to visit my cousin in San Francisco, and I came to a fork in the road, and I just felt this pull to go left instead of right down to I-5 and down to San Francisco.
Where you expected to go.
Yeah, and so the next thing I know, I'm going east, like on 80, like I think it was toward Winnemucca or something like that, and I said, what on earth am I doing? You know, and I just said, this is another one of these trips where I just get sent somewhere and don't find out what I'm supposed to do until I get there. So I kept driving east. Of course, I called my cousin and said, I can't make it, you know, and she just said, well, that's par for the course, you know, you don't, you know, that she just kind of, I had sort of a reputation of, you know, doing unexpected things.
Yes.
So I was driving east, and I was around Chicago, and it was there was this big storm, and all of a sudden this light came around the car, and I heard this voice that said, we want you to write a book. And I said, that's strange. There's nothing I want to say.
Uh-huh.
And so I kept driving, and when I got to New York, I stayed at my mother's house, and that
it's a long way from San Francisco, Peter.
Yeah, really. You know, it was like a week's drive here, and the whole time wondering, what am I doing? You know, so at some point, I guess the first night I got there, I meditated. I was sitting up in bed before I went to sleep, and I said, show me what I'm doing here. And again, that light came around me, and I heard this voice that said, we want you to write a book. So, you know, I had, the next day, I took out a yellow legal pad and put it on the desk, and I sat there thinking, I'm supposed to write a book, but I haven't a clue what to write about. My mind was blank, you know?
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, there are a lot of other things that happened leading up to this, but which will all be in my book, Adventures of a Western Mystic, that I'm working on.
Mm-hmm.
But, actually, the first thing that happened was a lady came to visit me, and I thought maybe we were going to be directed to be together, and there was a lot of love between us, and at some point I saw that this isn't what I was supposed to do, that I needed to sort of walk my path in a solitary way, and I realized later that was a big test, you know, like I felt like I was offered a relationship. Maybe it wasn't ever really going to happen, but in my mind, it's what I wanted.
Uh-huh.
And then at some point, I kept having these dreams that it was like something going to take me off the path.
Uh-huh.
And so after she left, I was very sort of heartbroken, and I wasn't even able to meditate. And then one day, I was sitting in this chair trying to meditate, and this ball of light came down out of the ceiling, and again I heard the voice that said, we want you to write a book. This is like the third time now.
And how far apart were these promptings?
The beings?
Well, the promptings.
Oh, the promptings? This is over
about writing a book.
Maybe a week or so.
Uh-huh.
Maybe 5 days. I don't know, something like that.
Uh-huh.
And so I said, well, write a book. What about what? And I heard this sentence. And I said, well, what comes after that? And it said, write the first sentence, then you'll get the second sentence.
Duh!
And, I had never done anything like this in my life, never tried to channel anything like that. So I went over to the desk where the pad was lying, And I picked up a pen, and I heard the voice say, no, pencil. And I thought, that's weird. So anyway, I picked up the pencil, and I wrote down the sentence that I heard. And sure enough, as soon as I started to write, I just heard this voice get, you know, continue. And at that point, this ball of light followed me to the desk. And out of the ball of light, this vast being, well, I don't say vast, but about 7 feet tall, like his head was almost up around the ceiling, wearing a white robe, and he had a panel of sapphires that from his waist hanging down toward the floor that were just, they were like focuses of light. And he just kept speaking so fast that I've never written so fast in my life. You know, unlike the book that I'm writing now where I like have to labor over each paragraph, you know, it's taken me like years and years to write. This whole book was completed in, I think, 10 days, a different master coming each day, sometimes two in one day. And at the end of the discourse, I mean, you know, people don't speak in perfect sentences with punctuation. So I just have pages of speech with no idea where to put the punctuation marks, you know. I mean, these sentences would go on for two pages, you know.
Uh-huh.
So, anyway, I was raised into my higher self during this first discourse where I had spherical vision. Now, Yogananda talks about that in Autobiography of a Yogi.
That his, spherical vision?
Yeah, well, I could see in a 360-degree circle. I mean, uh-huh. Up, down, left, right, to all the sides, you know, 360 degrees. It was like a fisheye lens on a camera.
Uh-huh.
And so I was up above the roof of the house. I could see the entire neighborhood. I could see the being beside me. I could look down and also see the manuscript below me. I could see myself writing in my physical body, writing like 15 feet below me.
Uh-huh.
And I could see the entire neighborhood. I could see the sun, the blue sky, the trees, the squirrels in the trees, the children playing down the street, all at once. And that only lasted a short time, but then I was back in my body, and the energy was just phenomenal. I mean, it was, I've never felt energy like that. In fact, at some point, I said, I can't take the energy anymore. And he said, you can and you will.
Ooh.
Yeah, and so, you know, I kept writing and feeling like I was dissolving, and he left, and then the next day a different being came. I mean, I had no idea what the plan was, you know.
Well, who was this being, the
first
one?
Well, that was the Great Divine Director. And that's not like really his name. That's sort of an office. It's sort of like President of the United States, but
uh-huh.
You know, they all have different names, but you say Mr. President. So,
isn't his name Master R?
Well, that would be Saint Germain. That would be short for Master Rakazi, and that was one of the names that he used in Europe. So they're, you know, they're... The masters go by different names at different times.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know the Great Divine Director is in charge of the. I don't want to take you off subject here, but I know the Great Divine Director has a retreat in which people can go request to be taken beyond sleep mm-hmm. and use what is called the Ascension Accelerator Chair, as mm-hmm. well as be. Instructed by him about whatever you're working on. Isn't that right?
I that sounds accurate to me. I had an experience in that chair, actually.
That
you
they did?
Call the Atomic Accelerator that's mentioned
yes.
in...
Yeah, talk about that.
Oh, my gosh. It happened, you know, many years ago, but actually, without much fanfare, I found myself taken into this retreat, and there was this beautiful, like, golden throne, and I was escorted to it, and there were three masters there, and I was just told to sit down in it and focus my attention on the I Am Presence, you know, go within as, into the center of my being, into my heart as much as I could, and then to do, they said, do the highest decree that you know, you know. And so I, you know, I basically decreed my oneness with God. And as this happened, they focused energy into this throne, and it started to give off this tremendous light. And I saw these blotches of dark light flow out, go out of my body and be consumed in the light.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that those were like negative thought patterns or injuries that I had had, places where I had stored negative ideas about myself or just negative thought forms that were stored somewhere in my body, and they just kept shooting out of me and were burned up in this light. And then I started raising higher and higher. I rose out of the chair, and I started going again into my I Am presence. And I just sort of lost consciousness at the point where I just became pure bliss. And I was very surprised to awaken in the morning in a physical body because I thought I had ascended.
Yeah.
But it talks about that process in, I think it's in The Magic Presence, where Daniel Rayborn was given that experience in the Atomic Accelerator. And they said that sometimes when people have work still to do in the world, they don't complete the process, that they still let you keep your physical body to sort of be a vehicle, just like you have a car to go places, that vehicle is for your service. So, you know, it took me a while to get used to, again, sort of to get acquainted with my body again. But, you know, so, I mean, that was the experience that I had. And as you come back into that body, after a while, you again sort of reintegrate your humanity. You know, you're still a human being. You still have a personality and certain, you know, wants, needs, and desires, but you never forget that connection with your I Am presence.
Well, you know, I wanted to tell people if they want to see an eye picture of their I Am presence now you have two websites, don't you?
No, Ascended, just the one, Ascended Adventures, and also you can access that just by going to petermountshasta.com. It's just PETERMTSHASTA, and it's the same website, but there are a couple of different ways to get to it.
Okay,
and there are excerpts from the book there.
Well, it's just a wonderful experience to hear Marlies chant, I Am,
mm-hmm.
and to see that beautiful, beautiful picture.
You know, I just bought that CD of Marlies's, I believe it's Invocation, isn't that the name of it?
You know, I don't know. I didn't know you could buy it.
Yeah, that's on the on my website when you first go to it and you hear her just doing that beautiful chant, I Am.
Uh-huh.
And it goes on for about 15 minutes, and that's sort of like meditating on the cover of the book. It's I Am the Open Door. You know, you just hear her chanting, I Am, and it takes you deeper and deeper within. And you can get that on that CD. If you go to starseedmusic.com, you can order it there.
Okay.
And I think that's a fantastic meditation. I mean, it's not the kind of thing you just put on to have as background music, although that you know, it's still working on you subliminally, you know.
But I think it's a good thing to put in background music. And, you know, another thing that I do is sometimes all day I have a DVD of The Violet Flame.
Mm.
I have a couple DVDs of The Violet Flame. And I just turn on the TV with no sound and just play The Violet Flame tape over and over. So every time I go by there, I see it and feel it. And I just think it's a good thing to do for your TV, too, because...
Where can you get that, The Violet Flame?
Oh, you can get The Violet Flame DVD from the St. Germain Foundation.
Oh, okay.
The St. Germain Foundation,
DVD.
Yeah, and they have a website. Just go to stgermainfoundation.com, and it's... It's the most lovely, most beautiful, and then I have violet flame lamps, too.
Oh, nice.
I have 9 of them that I keep on all the time.
That's great.
And, you know, it's very interesting, Peter. If the power goes off or something and the violet flame lamps aren't on,
Mm-hmm.
When you walk into the house, there's a totally different feeling. It's like the life has gone out of it.
Wow.
It's just such an amazing contrast, and I wonder if you would talk about your experience of using the violet flame.
Sure. You know, it took me a while to really believe that it was doing something, you know, because I didn't see it at first. And it sounded kind of like, you know, a little too new agey for me, you know. But
okay.
I kept trying it, you know, and I'd have experiences with it. And then I know someone who heard Pearl talking about it, and they sort of forgot exactly what to call it. They were checking into a hotel, I think, in Los Angeles, and I guess when they turned the light out at night, they saw these beings standing there in the room, and one of them said to the other, "Let's get her."
Ooh.
And you know, they were astral beings. They were disembodied spirits, you know.
Uh-huh.
And all she could remember was violet light. You know, she couldn't remember violet flame, or she couldn't remember the degree, the whole decree, but she said, "Violet light, come forth." And she said these beings just, like, vaporized, you know.
Oh, wow.
And I've had similar experiences traveling where I've called on the violet flame. And there's sometimes, like, if you're sitting with another person, like I used to sit with Pearl, and we would meditate with our eyes open, looking at each other.
Mm-hmm.
And as you go within, you start to see the other person sort of dissolve. And frequently when we did that, I would see this violet light in the room. You know, actually, my first experience with the violet flame was before I had actually read about it. It just happened spontaneously. Well, I would say spontaneously. It was probably a master trying to show me something. But I was in a health food store in Santa Fe after I'd come back from India, and I picked up a book in the health food store. It was called The Order of Melchizedek, and I think it's one that's out of print now. But as I flipped it open, I saw this violet light, like it was coming out of the book, and it went up my arm.
Uh-huh.
And every time I looked at it, it would sort of go away. But then I went back to reading the book, and I would see it again, just as like my arm was a neon tube or a bulb or something.
Uh-huh.
And then I guess I remembered in India when I was a guest of the Theosophical Society, I guess I had seen Unveiled Mysteries, I'd seen the I Am Discourses, I guess, and I remembered the name Violet Flame, and I said, well, I remember a book that had talked about that. So I went to the library in Santa Fe, and I checked out Unveiled Mysteries and, you know, The Magic Presence, and I guess when I started with Unveiled Mysteries, and I opened it up, and I go, oh, this is another one of those weird books, you know.
You did?
Yeah, it sounds too phenomenal to be true, you know, all the stuff.
Oh, because Godfrey Ray King met Saint Germain,
yeah,
on the path.
Yeah, and inside the retreats and the mountains and all the masters and all the jewels and all that stuff, you know, and I was in the kind of renunciation phase then, like, you know, I didn't want to hear about all this splendor. All I wanted to hear about was asceticism and renunciation, you know. And they were describing how opulent the retreats are and all that, you know. But I opened the book and I said, Saint Germain, if you're real and what's in this book is true, please show me. And the whole room filled with, I mean, really bright violet light. You know,
yeah.
I said, that's definitely a clue that there's some truth here, you know. So I think I stayed up like 2 days, you know, I read the book cover to cover.
Uh-huh.
And then I went, you know, eventually I met Pearl, and she said, hey, have you read Unveiled Mysteries? And I said, oh, no, not that book again, you know. So over the years, I would call on the violet flame whenever I wanted, like if I was sick or something was getting me down, if I was depressed. And a lot of the time, I wouldn't actually see it. It's more like an energy that goes through you.
Yeah, it's like it's like taking a weight off, isn't it?
Sure, absolutely.
You can feel it kind of leave your shoulders.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I want to encourage people to use the violet flame, to call on it, and also tell you that as you call on it, it will teach you of itself.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
I love it. That's great.
Because it is here to free us. from everything that doesn't serve.
Yeah, you know, and that's one of the greatest services that people can do is to call for the violet flame. You know, like I call for it to blaze through the Capitol in Washington and through the White House and for the president and his wonderful wife to be enfolded in it.
Yes.
And all the members of Congress and, you know, all the people in our government and, you know, all the governors of the states and all public officials and, you know, actually everyone. But sometimes I imagine that I'm in the center of the earth and I'm like this, there's this amethyst in my heart with the sun in it, inside of it. And it's just pouring out these rays of violet light through the entire earth. And then I ask Saint Germain and the angels of the violet flame to intensify my meditation and to send those rays out through the whole planet. And, you know, for them, that's nothing. There's no limitation. So, I mean, that's a very, very, you know, high meditation that you can do. So it not only raises you, but it raises everyone else as well.
You know, something else I've been doing that Marlise taught me, which is from Saima Lakshmi Devi, is to 108 times. Now, this is the way Marlise learned it. I am the violet consuming flame in manifestation and action. And when I started working with it, and someone actually sent me this beautiful, beautiful mala to do the 108 times, that it started being, I am the cosmic violet consuming flame of a thousand suns everywhere present in manifestation and action. And to me, that pretty much covers it. That is going to clean up everything everywhere. And when you call the cosmic action of any activity of the sacred fire, and then ask the ascended masters to intensify it and add their calls to ours, it is a service beyond our ability to assimilate, or, you know.
Well, I mean, you know, violet is one of the colors of the spectrum. It's not some new age thing that somebody cooked up, you know. It's one of the colors of the spectrum. It's the most purifying quality of light. So, you know, the actual knowledge that we can use that and invoke that, you know, is something very special that was a gift by Saint Germain. And it's interesting, I mean, to the masses, it was a gift to the masses by Saint Germain, but there are many other great teachers that use it. In fact, once I was looking at a picture of Sai Baba, and I wondered what he thought of the violet flame. And at that point, I saw this violet light come out of the picture. And he said, I use the violet flame too.
Well, you know, it has the highest vibration and frequency. In fact, there was a blurb that came out from one of the major paint companies about 3 or 4 years ago that violet, let's see, I think it was called Violet Tulip, was the color of the year. And there was an explanation about how violet vibrates, it's like 300 trillion times a second or something. I can't remember exactly what it was, but I was so impressed that mainstream was acknowledging that.
Sure.
You know, I think that's a sign of the times, Peter.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and purple's very big in fashion now, too.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, it is, and not just in Mount Shasta. How did you get the name Peter Mount Shasta?
Well, you know, maybe it was to keep me from judging other people that changed their names or something, you know. I had come back from India, and, you know, I spent time with Ram Dass, and, well, you know, Ram Dass was given his name by Neem Karoli Baba. He'd been Richard Alpert, and I'd say most of the people in that scene had Hindu names, and I held steadfastly to, you know, my name, and I said, I'm not into changing names, and I saw that it didn't really lessen people's egos. In fact, sometimes it increased the ego, thinking, well, I'm this special person, and I have this Hindu name given to me by my guru, you know. So I was pretty much against changing one's name. And the first time I came to Mount Shasta after I'd come back from India, this is before I saw Pearl or I had the experience in Muir Woods with St. Germain, I was camping on the mountain, and I'd been fasting for 5 days. And I woke up one morning, the sun hadn't come up yet over the side of the mountain, but it was getting light. And what woke me up was that somebody was talking to me. And I looked around, and I couldn't see anybody, but there was this, you know, audible voice. I never had an experience like that before. And whoever it was talking knew all about me, knew I'd been to India, and then started to tell me where I was going next, that I was going back to India. And I said, no way. I almost died in India the first time. I'm not going back there. And he said, well, you will. And then he said that I would eventually come back.
You can and you will.
Yeah, I'd come back to Mount Shasta, and that would be my home. And I said, no way. I have a farm in upstate New York, you know, near Woodstock, and I love it there. And I'm not going to leave that place to live here. And then again, he said, you will. And I said, no, I won't. And then finally he said, and from now on, you're going to use the name of the mountain as your name. And I said, no way. And he said, well, yes, you will. And I said, you got to be kidding. Peter Mount Shasta? And he said, yes. And I said, there's no way I'm going to do that. And then he said, finally, I argued with him. You know, this is why the masters actually don't give people messages more often than directly. Because you're not going to like what they tell you, you know. They're not going to tell you to do all the things that you want to do and that, you know, that you're always like this reincarnation of some great being. They might tell you you were actually a scoundrel in a past life, you know, and people don't want to hear that stuff, or that you have to do something unpleasant that you don't want to do, or, you know, something like that. So, anyway, you know, finally, at the end of the conversation, you know, when I said for the last time, I'm not going to change my name, he just said, he kind of said like a parent. He said, we shall see. And so, you know, after a while, I was sort of writing a little booklet that was a poem, actually. And after a while, I started thinking, well, it doesn't hurt just to use that as a pen name, you know.
Well, was this after the I Am the Open Door came?
No, this was way before.
Okay.
That I Am the Open Door came after I'd been with Pearl for about 5 years, I guess.
Okay.
So, you know, I didn't tell anybody, though, that was my name. I just wrote this one little booklet under that name, and I went back to my farm near Woodstock, you know, and then sure enough, like, Sai Baba appeared to me and called me to go to India. I went back to India just as St. Germain said I would, and then Sai Baba said, meditate on I Am that I Am, and that brought me back to Muir Woods and meeting St. Germain, who sent me back to Mount Shasta, and there I was, just the way St. Germain said I would be, like the year before. And by then, there were people who'd read my booklet, and they started calling me Peter Mount Shasta. You know? So, you know, eventually, you know, that became the legal name. So I guess I'm sort of stuck with it. You know, I've every now and then thought of changing it to something else, or, you know, but it keeps coming that's the handle I'm supposed to use, you know.
Well,
I certainly can't judge anybody else. There's some real interesting names that people are using, you know, and I'm in no position to, you know, make light of anybody else's name now.
Well, you know, that kind of brings us to right action. And the thing that struck me about reading I Am the Open Door a number of times was that if you want freedom, you have to give freedom.
That's beautiful.
And in this discourse from Godfrey Ray King, he talks about people wanting to impose their will or their knowing of the right way on others, and how that operates with parents and children. And I've thought so often, I've seen parents that they want their child to be an athlete, or they want their child to be a doctor, or they want their child to marry a certain person, and they think they really know the best for them.
Yeah, that's terrible when that happens, you know. I mean, you don't really know what's right for another person. Of course, as a parent, it's a little tricky because they chose you as a parent. You're supposed to exert some influence, but you really have to respect that God direction is coming through the child, you know?
Yeah.
In fact, I was there's some Tibetan lamas in town. I hung out with them for a while last night, and I said, how did you get to be a lama? And he said, well, his parents wanted him to take over the family business, and they kept putting pressure on him to do that. And he kept saying he wanted to be a monk, and they said, well, we don't want you to be. You know, we want you to go into business. And one day, some high lama stopped by their house and had dinner with them, and he prostrated at the feet of the lama and said, all I want to do is be a monk and be a lama. I don't want to be a businessman. So the lama spoke to the parents and said, you know, this child is being called to that. It's really wrong to force this guy into business, you know. So then the parents really had to listen, and so that started him on the path to being a monk. They, you know, they dropped the pressure to, make him into a businessman.
That's so wonderful that he was given that assistance, because a lot of times that doesn't happen. And a lot of times people feel pressured by their parents their whole life.
Oh, totally. Or by their mate, you know.
Oh, yeah. I've been thinking about this a lot since I read this, and especially I see it with people that get married, that they think the marriage license gives them the right to dictate the person's actions.
Mm. You know, I just met a couple, very beautiful couple that, they fell in love, they got married, and then there was like this battle for control that went on between them.
Uh-huh.
You know, that they felt kind of controlled by the other. So they got divorced, and then they separated, but then they really missed each other. You know, so they got back together, just living together sort of as friends.
Uh-huh.
And they get along great, and they really love each other, and they have a life together, but they just let go of the whole control thing, you know?
That's so important.
Yeah. So, what they call right action in India and in Tibet, you know, it's like the term dharma. That's actually a Sanskrit term, but it's, you know, like the path of right action.
Uh-huh.
And I like to think that if you don't do the dharma, you get the karma. You know, like but the thing is, you never know what the dharma is for another person.
See, but I always thought dharma was just about your own divine blueprint mission, about fulfilling that. What?
Yeah, well, it means a number of things. I mean, your dharma is your own particular practice in life, or your own particular path. But it's also like spiritual law, you know. So it sort of manifests in different ways. But you know, it's hard to know in advance. Like they have all kinds of laws about what to do in different circumstances. But when it comes right down to the action, you don't know what the right thing is till you get to that moment. You know, the moment to act.
Well, you know, going back to when you're talking about, you know, you planned on going to San Francisco and then you were really prompted to go to New York, that takes a great deal of surrender and trust. And I don't know a lot of people who have done that, Peter.
Hmm. Well, you get to a point when you get tired of trying to do things with your will, you know, and making a mess of things. You know,
and your good idea department.
Yeah, and, you know, especially after I found the I Am teachings, that energizes, I mean, it can energize your human will if you use that divine power. So you can create all kinds of things. You know, like there's that, what is that video out, you know, The Secret?
Uh-huh.
You know, about how to use divine intent to get what you want.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, then they don't tell you what to do with all the junk that you create in your life, you know, using that, you know what I mean? So you have to kind of really ask first, do I really need this? I mean, is this for my highest good? Before I start creating, you know, millions of dollars and Porsches and all kinds of partners and, you know, all that stuff, you know, then you're going to end up, having to deal with all that stuff and maybe praying to get rid of some of it or the complications that come with it, you know.
Yes.
So it came to a point in my life where I just sat down one day and I said, thy will, meaning the I am presence,
yes,
be done, not my will, not my human will. So it's like turning everything over to my higher self rather than my lower self and just using that divine power for what was really my dharmic path, not just what my human self wanted at the moment, you know?
Yes, just real surrender.
Yeah, and I think when I thought about talking about right action, the topic was suggested to me by the fact that today is Memorial Day.
Yes.
And it's a day when we remember those who died fighting for our country, or at least they thought that's what they were doing, you know?
Yes.
I mean, probably all those wars were unnecessary. I mean, they were definitely unnecessary.
Yes.
But they were somehow a karmic working out of, some group delusion, I guess. And, I knew Dean Rusk and Robert McNamara. Robert McNamara was Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam War. And, you know, he later said that war was a mistake. We never should have been involved in it. You know, this is after the death of 50,000 Americans and I don't know how many Vietnamese.
Duh.
The whole war was unnecessary.
Duh.
But what was the Dharma for each of those soldiers? I mean, this is the day when I think, you know, it's auspicious to pray for them that may any trauma that they went through be dissolved by the violet consuming flame.
Oh, let's just do that right now, Peter. And you just call, I'd like to ask everyone who uses the violet flame to just call it forth in their own way and ask our audience to join us, add your calls to ours, and the Ascended Masters add your calls to ours.
Yeah, so call on Saint Germain and the angels of the violet consuming flame to blaze that violet flame up and around and through every being that died in any of the wars in which we've been involved, and dissolve and consume any karmic accumulation, any trauma, any negative associations in any way, and, you know, to free them from that experience and clear their karma entirely, so that if they need to re-embody, they re-embody in a family of light and can achieve their liberation, divine consciousness, and ascension in their next lifetime.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I can really feel that, you know.
Yeah.
You just imagine those angelic beings above the earth and in those other realms where those beings may be dwelling, just purifying them.
Yeah.
And liberating them from that.
And some of them are back in Iraq, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So those who are on Earth now and involved in war,
mm-hmm.
we ask for that awakening that takes place before 50,000 people are killed.
Mm. Yeah.
We call for that awakening that saves the waste of divine life.
Yeah, what if you could awaken those people that were the ones organizing the wars, you know?
This is what we're asking for. That is, I am the cosmic violet flame of a thousand suns everywhere present in manifestation and action.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you know, how do we know that it wasn't that someone was calling forth that activity of the violet flame that caused it to reveal itself to you?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah, and we call for the redeeming and freedom of all life everywhere by whatever activity of the sacred fire is necessary.
Yeah, call for the violet flame to go through, like, the president of Iran.
That, well, know, just do it, Peter.
Yeah.
Let's not instruct, just
yeah,
do
okay.
it.
Okay, well, I am the presence of God, blazing the violet consuming flame through the president and government of Iran, Iraq, and all other countries in the Middle East.
Afghanistan, Pakistan,
all those countries where it's needed, and through our own government, through our own military.
Korea and China.
Absolutely, through Korea and China, may the violet flame blaze forth there, or wherever it's needed.
And to awaken every life stream and life form to the real value of life, to the real honoring of life, to the real loving of the divine presence in each one, so there's divine revelation and each one is awakened to the truth of loving all others and being in divine service. So we ask for the redemption of all energy that's been distorted and used in hatred and war.
Mm-hmm. You know, the masters say that there's like a war entity that's created even before war breaks out, which is sort of the accumulated anger and hatred of a group of people. And that war entity is created by the media. You know, they stir people up. They say, oh, this horrible thing has been done to your country. Like someone has sunk one of your ships, you know,
mm-hmm.
or someone has bombed one of your buildings. And you should be angry at that country. So a lot of anger and hatred is generated at those people, and then those people in turn reply with anger and hatred. And then before you know it, you've got a war going on, and that, of course, once people start being killed, all the parents of those people, you know, they start feeling more anger, and it creates an actual entity, like a living being. It's sort of like a monster that just feeds on that hatred and gets stronger from it. And that, you know, one of the jobs that the masters have to stop war is in dissolving those war entities.
Yes, and we...
you know, asking them to intercede and to prevent those entities from being formed like is a very powerful aid. I mean, the more we call on the masters, the more they can jump in and help out. Like, for a while, the previous administration was trying to stir people up against Iran, you know, and saying, well, it's just a matter of time before we have to nuke them and stuff like that. You know, and now that seems to have been dissolved.
That's so good, because Iraq never did anything to anybody.
That's right.
I'll never forget the films I saw of the people in Iraq, so happy, so blessed, so loving the day before our troops went in there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not acknowledged that Americans are doing the same thing every day there that was done 9/11 here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for me, the easiest thing, Peter, is I go to the mom thing.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in those countries has a mom.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Everybody in those countries has a family that loves them. And so I don't see my children as any different than their children.
Absolutely. Well, you come back to the basic premise of Buddhism, which is that every single sentient being in the universe wants to avoid suffering and to be happy. And it's just through confusion and misunderstanding and fear, you know, that these wars and disputes arise.
Well,
look at everyone, as you say, as a relative, you know, like the Buddhists say, or the Tibetans say, see everyone as your mother. Everyone has either been your mother or will be your mother at some point in time.
And if you're on this planet, you better hope your mother isn't a cow.
Yeah, right. That's right.
So we call to the heart of the great central sun and all the ascended masters for the redeeming, purifying, violet flaming love and power of such purity to come forth and redeem all life everywhere and release all life from all war forever.
Beautiful.
To release all life from all suffering forever. Before we go, Peter, I wanted to do this one decree that You know, we've kind of gotten into decreeing. In the next show that we do, I hope you'll come back. And I think we ought to talk about the service of decreeing.
Is that the end of our...
I think that's the... Can I just do this one decree, Don?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. I am the sacred fire's almighty command that the suffering of all life in this world and all others shall now cease forever. Thank you for being with us, Peter. Thank you for listening. God bless you, and may all your dreams come true.
Thank you, Iris. God bless you, and God bless everyone listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep shining until then. Happy trails to you till we meet again. I love you, and this is my wish for you, that all your dreams come true and are 1,000 times more wonderful than you ever dreamed possible. Ah, men, ah, women, ah, children, and yeehaw!